Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
People live in a world of their own making. Frankly, that seems to be the problem. Welcome to Angry Planet.
Hello and welcome to Angry Planet. I'm Jason Fields.
And I'm Matthew Galt.
We've talked a lot on this program about electronic intelligence. The amazing stuff you can do with satellites, user-generated content, and sophisticated software. Nice. But we've left out all the men and women who still do work on the ground all over the world. Paul Colby is here to remind us about human intelligence and the role it plays. Colby is a CIA veteran, having worked in the Directorate of Operations for 25 years before moving on to private industry. He's currently Director of Intelligence Project at the Belfer Center at Harvard. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you guys.
Well, I'd like to eventually get to the impact of human intelligence in the war in Ukraine, but you've had some unique experiences, and I was hoping we could start there.
Sure.
Okay. So you were Chief Central Eurasia Division. What does that mean? What's the actual job?
So at the time, CIA was broken into a couple of different directorates. So you had a director of operations, which was focused on human intelligence collection, and director of analysis. These are the folks that put together all source intelligence to produce finished intelligence assessment for national security community and the president. You had a director of support, which was taking care of all of the business operations of the agency, how you establish facilities, how you travel, how you put up communications, how you have security. And you had a directorate of science and technology, which was focused both on big ticket collection platforms, but also in supporting operations with things like communication devices, disguises, things like that. And so going back to your question, what was Chief Central Eurasia Division? So Director of Operations was broken into geographic components, and Central Asia encompassed former Soviet Union, former Warsaw Pact, Balkan, Central Asia. So I was responsible for operations that took place basically in areas of the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and Balkans.
And what year did you start?
I came on board in 1984 under Reagan. Bill Casey was director of CIA at the time. And the agency was going through a rebuilding period after the drawdowns post-Vietnam.
So really, you lived through many different changes in both the CIA and in Central Europe.
Yeah, yes. When I came on, it was, full-on Cold War. No one expected the Soviet Union was going to go away, let alone collapse. And then there was a post Cold War era, that period in the 90s when many were declaring end of history and peace at our time and no longer had a need for CIA because we had faced no more threats in the world. And then 9/11 came along and the agency switched to 20 years of primarily counterterrorism operations.
Is that how it operates? I mean, I just was thinking there's this with the FBI most wanted list. It sort of reflects what the FBI cares about. It's not that this person is actually more wanted than that person. It's just we're doing terror this year. So does the...
CIA doesn't decide to do, we're going to do terror this year. It's not rocket science. It's really focused on what policymakers and particularly what the president needs. So what are the things that are foremost on their agenda? Those are the things that CIA is going to be focused on. And you can break that down into near-term, exigent, you know, quite pressing matters, disrupting terrorist attacks that are going to happen, countering intelligence operations designed to steal U.S. secrets, anticipate oncoming war. But then you also have long wave issues. You know, what's the trajectory of China technology and its implications for national security over the next 30 years? So you have both near term, very pressing, right up in your face issues that the president needs answers to right now. And then you have the longer term assessments of how do we need to be formulating U.S. policy over the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years?
So let's talk a little bit specifically about your job, if that's cool with you. So what did you do? What's the actual job as a chief? And does everybody know what you're doing? Meaning like, you know, are you living with a fake beard somewhere in an undisclosed location, or does everybody know that that's your job?
Yeah. Well, I'm talking in a real beard right now. So most operations officers are working under some sort of cover. Diplomatic cover, it can be commercial cover, but when you're in the field, you don't go away around wearing your CIA t-shirt and advertising where you work for lots of reasons, right? It's a clandestine service. It's designed to steal secrets. It's designed to conduct espionage in places that don't want you to steal their secrets. So, operations officers in particular tend to spend most of their careers undercover. There comes a point in time when you're at a certain level and have you know, a certain number of scars and exposures and things like that, that cover really doesn't mean so much anymore. And in some cases can be a burden and a distraction. So by the time I was leading a division in CIA, you know, I was declared, i.e. the official representative to dozens of intelligence services, had met with dozens of different intelligence officers from dozens of other countries who knew that they were dealing with CIA. There's a point where a cover is important and a point where it's not needed as much.
How do you even get into this line of work?
That's a great question. So it's, there's a million different paths in. Mine was, you know, some ways accidental, some ways intentional. I knew I wanted to be working overseas. I thought I wanted to be working in the State Department. The process for all of the agencies, both at the time and now, can be very long. So I did a bunch of other things while I was waiting. I worked in a ski patrol. I whitewater rafted. I worked in hotels. I dipped chrome in a factory. I did lots of different things, all of which in the end, I think, helped prepare me for a CIA career. But most importantly, I think the agency needs folks who've been around a bit. They tend not to take folks straight out of college. They want some real life experience. And it's good to have, a few scars, a little bit of scar tissue and some, experience with failure, because the intelligence business is a really tough one. And everything, you know, all grades aren't A, and you're often, operations often fail.
So it's not like movies that show people from a particular part of Yale are selected from campus and immediately start working at the CIA. There's no, you know, sort of secret cabal. It's not all skull and bone.
No, way back in the day, sort of during the times of OSS, there was, a phrase that the CIA is pale, Yale, and male. And it wasn't entirely wrong. There was a lot of self-selection from Ivy League schools. Bill Donovan, who started the OSS, which was the World War II forerunner of the CIA, conducted sabotage and intelligence operations behind the lines in the Asia theater and as well as European theater. It did select a lot of folks from their own circles. Weirdly enough, heavily, many of them lawyers. But now the agency needs a much different workforce, being a global agency with the necessity to work everywhere in the world. We need to be able to have the languages, the ethnic backgrounds, the cultural literacy that enable people to blend seamlessly in any number of different scenarios.
What was your motivation for getting in? Why did you want to get in?
I thought it was going to be really interesting and fun. It sounded like a cool job. I was pretty naive about what it would actually entail, but I wasn't wrong. And I wasn't disappointed in that. I actually left law school to join the agency, thought I would come back after a couple of years of bouncing around, but it was just so exhilarating. The stakes were so high. The people that you worked with were of such high quality. And it was just so satisfying to be to be part of something that you felt was both bigger than you, and also it was focused on a mission that you felt was important. So it was really addictive, going to different places, learning different languages, being involved in different operations. Was fantastic life.
When I watch a show like The Americans, I'm not going to ask you, is that real? You know, it's really like, actually, the question is, for me, is any aspect of it accurate? Is there any small part of something like The Americans that is what the life's like?
Well, there's a couple of things that were accurate. So it's obviously Hollywoodized, but the fact that there were Russian illegals, an illegal is an intelligence officer who is working without official cover or without diplomatic cover. So The Americans portrayed two persons who came over to the United States, Soviet agents who pretended to be, I can't remember what their characters were, but one was a housewife. No, they were travel agents, right? So pretty good cover. But they had no protection in case of arrest. In real life, in 2010, 10 different couples were arrested. And in one of the greatest counterintelligence coups in CIA history, one of the greatest counterintelligence defeats for the Russian in history, they were arrested, held for a while, and then swapped for American agents, i.e. Russians who'd been working on behalf of American intelligence services, who'd been captured and were imprisoned by the Russians. They were swapped for that. So that there's a kernel of truth in that. The other piece that was, I think, well done, were the relationships that you saw between, different individuals, relationships in particular between, officers and their agents on both sides. So the FBI officers' relationships with, people he was dealing with, their relationships in terms of how they developed people, how they manipulated them, how they recruited them, how they tried to keep them safe. There was a lot of elements of reality there.
Did we do the same thing?
Did we do the same thing in terms of the United States?
You know, I mean, were we doing the same thing?
Intelligence services all have similar methodologies, all work in similar ways, all use similar tradecraft and techniques.
What does a day look like? And I guess, what does a day look like in 1984? And what does a day look like now?
Boy, it just depends on where you're at, whether in the field or at headquarters. But I think probably most interesting is in the field. So, if you're in a country somewhere in Southeast Asia or in Africa, you're with the station. I mean, your role is to be, if you're an operations officer working at a station, primary job is to collect human intelligence, to run the agent networks that let you know the plans and intentions of issues that you want to, that they're important for national security or for national policy, to be able to spot, identify, and recruit those agents, to handle them effectively. So a typical day, every day is a little bit different, but you'll have a cover job that you're working that sort of presents your face to the world. And then when that job is over at night, you may be out meeting people, you may be out developing relationships, and you may be out drinking late into the hours, forming long-lasting bonds. You're always trying to understand what makes people tick. You know, what are the things that motivate them? What are the things that drive them? What are the things they're afraid of? What are the threats or risks that they face? What are the problems that they have? All of which can be used as you work them towards developing an official relationship, an agent relationship with the agency.
How do you decompress from that?
How do you decompress from that? probably the same way everyone else does. You know, you find with friends and with family and with activities and sports and travel and just, you know, I think it's the same as with everything. I mean, you go about in the midst. It's, I think, one of the interesting pieces of it or difficult pieces of it for people is the need to compartment different parts of your life, right? So there were entire parts of your life that you don't tell your wife about, that your kids don't know about, your best friends don't know about. Some of the best things that you do in the course of your career, nobody but a very small circle of people among your peers or within your unit or organization ever know about. And so you have to be able to handle those two things at once.
So let's just say that your working is, covertly, does the person that you are supposed to be, if they need a vacation, if if you're working like a regular job, they get vacations too. Do you do a fake vacation then?
Do you do a fake vacation?
Or do you actually get to go and relax?
You do get to go and relax. Sometimes you do go on a fake vacation where you're ostensibly going off on vacation, but you're actually going off to do a job somewhere. So that's happened. There were times where I would, to the outside world, I was taking a trip to the United States to see family, but in actuality, I was going off somewhere else to meet someone in some dark corner.
All right, Angry Planet listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, Angry Planet listeners, we are back.
Does the popular perception of the CIA kind of an American culture, and I know it's mixed, but especially like coming in 1984, right? We're just kind of coming off of the Church Committee stuff. How did that affect you, and what do you make of it?
So the Church, if folks aren't familiar, Church Committee were congressional investigations in the 70s, which uncovered abuses in the CIA and in some cases breaking the law in the CIA in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and some different programs were revealed. They call it the family jewels. And in response to those hearings, congressional oversight was established, and some additional sort of controls and restrictions. But the popular perception is that the CIA just, it's a rogue elephant, just runs out on its own, does what it wants. But actually, CIA is entirely responsive to direction from the executive, i.e. the president, the National Security Council, and then the different commands that need support. So the CIA is a little bit like a Swiss Army knife in terms of it's pretty small, but it has a great ability to be nimble and flexible and responsive, much more than almost any other component of the U.S. government, because of some of the special authorities that it has, but also because of the culture of responsiveness to mission and responsiveness to needs. And folks, it's what folks sign up for. It's what they want to be doing. So within days of 9/11, teams, CIA teams with embedded special forces going into northern Afghanistan to meet up with the Northern Alliance to launch the campaign against the Taliban.
Question about how the CIA's troops, I mean, is that accurate? How do you work with another, special operations force? Is that something that's smooth? Do you call ahead and say, hey guys, we're going to, so don't bring your, troops in the same location. It's just interesting because it sounds like in some ways you're doing the same jobs as other parts of the government.
Sure. So the one component of the CIA within the operations directorate are the, it used to be called Special Activities Division. These are former military operators, tier one operators, or former SEALs, former Delta, former Marine Recon, who've left the military and are now working in the paramilitary division, paramilitary component of the CIA. How is that different what the U.S. military does? Well, one is they're able to operate with very low profile and conduct the operations, engagements, training, et cetera, outside of the public eye. And again, with a great deal of flexibility and with additional authorities. And they, you know, they were used in Vietnam, in Balkans, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and just about every place in the world that you've seen threats manifest to America, particularly terrorist threats. They're a very high speed, very high quality, very highly motivated group of individuals, quite small. They have very close relationships with their counterparts in U.S. military. And you'll see different missions will have different mixes. So sometimes you might have units that are working together. Sometimes you might have military officers that are embedded with those units. But it's kept separate because of the additional authorities that CIA has that the military doesn't, and because it can operate more secretly.
Cool. So I was wondering, you had worked in the Balkans. I'm going to guess that was during the various wars in the Balkans, as opposed to just hanging out in the Balkans. Were there any lessons that you learned from that then apply to Ukraine? Or am I just saying, you know, these are Slavs. Maybe there's, you know, some connection there.
No, I think there's some real lessons from the Balkans that we're seeing repeat in it with Ukraine. So first, history matters, right? Americans tend to not be that focused on history. And, you know, we have a hard time thinking, you know, 5 or 10 years back, let alone, you know, 50, 100 or 500. In many places in the world, history from 100 years ago, 250 years ago and farther back is still living history. Is still part of culture, still part of identity. And there's old grudges that come back. And we certainly saw that in the Balkans, a country that had been under communist rule under Tito, you know, a unified, actually one of the more successful and prosperous socialist states. But in the thrall of Milosevic's nationalist rhetoric, splintered apart into different ethnic components, didn't necessarily have to go that way. And splinter in a very violent fashion. We're seeing some of those same lessons of history play out with Ukraine right now. I the way I think about the war in Ukraine is that folks for a long time said, well, the Soviet Union broke up and it was amazing that it was done peacefully. Well, I think we're seeing the extended breakup of the Soviet Union and some violence that goes with that. It was just a delayed fuse, if you will. I think the other piece, and I touched on it, it's the power and insidious nature of nationalism, how addictive and destructive it can be for populations that feel aggrieved, that have resentment, that maybe are looking at their neighbors and are resentful that they're doing better and are searching for a reason for that. And we've certainly now seen Putin play on the nationalist card in Russia to such an extent that he was, you know, in a bit of skewed history, dialing back 1,000 years, trying to erase Ukrainian identity, saying that there is no separate identity of Ukraine separate from Russia, apart from Russia, and launching a war, which is, I think, you know, much more about that identity and what Russia feels as a threat, existential threat to it, not a military threat from NATO, though they claim that exists, but an identity threat. They think that a prosperous, Western-oriented, democratic Ukraine poses a profound threat to an authoritarian state capitalist state-controlled society that you see in Russia now.
So if you were Russia and you were getting ready to invade Ukraine, what would you do? I mean, from an intelligence standpoint, how do you get rid
of it?
What do you do for the ground, you know, to prime?
Yeah, I hate to give them any pointers because they're really screwing it up, you know, on their own pretty well. What are mistakes that Russia made in this? This was a colossal intelligence failure on Russia's part. They believed their own rhetoric and messaging that there were, you know, millions of Ukrainians who were simply waiting for Russian liberators to roll into Kyiv, who would welcome them with, you know, bread and salt, which is sort of a Slavic version of, you know, flowers and kisses. Dead wrong on that. They were dead wrong on Ukraine's capability to fight and will to fight. They were dead wrong on the stability and strength of Ukrainian leadership. They thought Zelensky was a clown. They thought he was nothing more than the sitcom character that he had portrayed. It's also one of the great ironies of history that Zelensky, you know, essentially auditioned for his role as president of wartime Ukraine by playing an accidental president on TV. It's really something to go back and watch some of those episodes. What other mistakes did they make? They believe their own propaganda about the strength of their own forces, you know, so they've gone, you know, since Putin came to power, they've been on a systematic rebuilding program to take what was the Soviet army and its equipment and to build, you know, what they saw as a more modern, more capable, more flexible force. So they had all the trappings of it, right? They didn't eliminate the draft, but they tried conscription, still have conscription. But instead of everyone being conscripted, they tried to form a core of a professional army, i.e. people, what they call contractors, you know, folks who sign an agreement and are volunteers, essentially. So they tried to build a volunteer force. They modernized with weapons, but they didn't change many of the things that, that we've now seen to be real Achilles heels for them. There's still a central command and control, troops at the ground level. Units have very little initiative, very little authority, and huge disincentives for taking any decisions or actions because all blame flows down. Their equipment actually turns out to be really poor, much of it coming out of poorly maintained stocks. Their leadership has been abysmal, and the effect of corruption in the services is hard to overestimate. There were recently a member of Duma, that's their parliament, their Congress, who was complaining, saying, well, you know, what's happened to the 2 million winter uniforms that we, you know, authorized and paid for? Well, I'm pretty sure that those uniforms are being sold in a flea market somewhere in Guangzhou or Xinjiang province because of the level of corruption and incompetence is huge. That all said, it's a big army. It's nuclear armed, has, you know, huge firepower. So while they've made tremendous mistakes, the war is not going to be over quickly, despite Ukraine's success, I believe.
But just really what I'm wondering is, were they set up so that they have operatives inside, like the Ukrainian intelligence service? I mean, do you do some kind of prep? You know, it's like, we're coming, so... Yeah, we better send Paul in to do X.
The Russian intelligence services would have had vast operations within Ukraine. They would have recruited agents in Ukrainian security services and the military. They would have had GRU, that's their military intelligence services, operatives on the ground, spotting targets, planning sabotage. They would have been reporting back on Ukrainian preparations, locations of military units and fortifications and supply. And they would have been providing reporting back on, you know, what they expected to happen. politically. There's been reporting that there were assassination units that were in place and that were working to kill Zelensky on the very eve of the invasion. But that they were identified and neutralized. So yes, there's no doubt that, you know, just as by virtue of history, but also of language, of family ties, of contacts and friendships, that there have been a lot of advantages for Russian intelligence services to work in and operate in Ukraine. That said, Ukrainian counterintelligence services have been really active, and it looks like quite successful in identifying and neutralizing many of those operations.
Have you been surprised at how any of this has played out?
Sure. Yeah, I've been surprised by a lot of it, how it's played out. I was surprised at the level of Russian incompetence, that at their overconfidence, that their belief that they could take Kyiv in 3 days and essentially have a palace coup and that it would all be over. They completely underestimated the will of Ukrainian people to fight. I've been surprised at how slow they've been to learn lessons. They quickly retreated to both retreated, but also retreated to old Soviet doctrine, which is, you know, essentially line up massive amounts of artillery, obliterate everything within a particular geographic square, and then move in. It's what they did in Chechnya, in the Second War in Chechnya, where if you've seen the pictures of Grozny, they simply leveled the city to take out the Chechen fighters. I've been surprised at, I have not been surprised at their ability to repress dissent, in Russia, vast state mechanisms to both intimidate or, folks from protesting, to have extremely, draconian, criminal, penalties for, you know, standing alone and holding a sign that, you know, might even suggest criticism. What surprises me is how many people still stand up and protest. But I think over time, the support for the war is going to erode as more bodies come back and as the true economic cost comes into play.
And Poland, what happened in Poland yesterday? From what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, parts of anti-missile defense systems that were Ukrainian landed in Poland and killed some people.
So Russia has been, because they've been unsuccessful on fighting the Ukrainian army, it looks to me like they're one of their main strategies for trying to win the war is to take out as much Ukrainian infrastructure as they can. So lights, heat, power, water, to make a cold, dark winter for Ukrainian citizens to undermine their morale and to reduce support for the war and to reduce support for Zelensky. It's had exactly the opposite effect. It's strengthened the determination of Ukrainians to fight Russia and to take back, every inch of their land that they've lost. They're not being intimidated, but nonetheless, you've got, you know, up to a third of Ukrainian citizens without power as we go into a very cold winter. Who is counting on that? It's really a cynical and cruel campaign. So yesterday, this is just after the, G20, summit, they launched, reports of 100 cruise missiles, armed drones, in targeting Ukrainian civilian facilities. Ukraine tries to down as many of these as they can with anti-aircraft missiles, with anti-aircraft weapons. It looks like one of those systems, an S-300 surface-to-air missile system, either hit Russian munitions or ended up landing, you know, 4 miles inside Poland. So it does not look like it was a deliberate Russian attack. It looks like unfortunate collateral damage from the scale of air warfare and combat that's taking place in Ukraine. The only thing that surprises me is this hasn't happened more.
Are you worried about this thing expanding?
Yes. Yeah, it's an extraordinarily dangerous situation. Look, you've got, you know, massed conventional combat on European territory, with one of those combatants being nuclear armed, losing badly, and making not thinly veiled threats about use of those nuclear weapons. And so that's why you've seen efforts across U.S. government and other governments to dissuade and deter Russia from employing nuclear weapons in any circumstance. But the potential, as we saw yesterday with, you know, the immediate conclusion that folks jumped to was that this is a Russian expansion of the attacks. This is testing NATO. You know, this is, you know, could be an expansion of the war. You could have, you know, accidental situations end up escalating quite quickly. Part of the reason why you saw President Biden and others being very cautious in their preliminary assessment, saying, let's wait till we have the facts in. You know, we completely support Poland. We'll pull together folks. We'll do everything we need to do to defend NATO, but we're going to determine what actually happened before we rush off.
So I had only one more question. Matthew, if you have anything else, let me know. But I was curious about your career after you left the CIA. I mean, from the bio I read, it sounds like you basically created a CIA for BP, the big petroleum company. I mean, is that essentially, did you do something like that? And are there private CIAs out there?
Well, that's it. So we'll take a step back. In the private sector, there's every bit as much of a need for intelligence, i.e. good information, for decision-making as there is in government. So when executives are deciding, is it safe, you know, for us to work in this, to send people in this location, to open up a plant? Do we face threats from terrorism or from violent crime or from civil unrest or political instability? These are all questions that are as pertinent for companies across the world as it is for government. And so you see a quite quiet, I think probably underappreciated, but rapidly evolving and rapidly growing ecosystem of private sector intelligence companies and capabilities. Some of them are vendor companies that provide essentially outsourced services. And that can be everything. So you think about companies like Planet Labs that provide geospatial intelligence, that provide imagery, satellite-based imagery of different locations. That's intelligence. Not that many years back, that capability would have been among the most expensive and most classified in U.S. government. So remember the old spy satellites, the pictures of during the Cuban Missile Crisis? But states, i.e., you know, superpowers, had a monopoly on that. Now, everybody who's got an iPhone has even more powerful capability as you pull up Google Maps or Google Earth or whatever other platform you might use. So that's an extraordinary revolution. And companies are using that kind of capability in thousands of different ways. They're using it for environmental monitoring. They're using it to monitor methane emissions. They're using it to understand deforestation. They're using it to understand water and resource issues. In the same way, companies often operate in places that are, you know, dangerous, obscure, opaque, have bad governance or highly corrupt. It's really important to be able to have a capability that lets you navigate through those environments in an ethical, legal, and safe manner. And so that's why you see these intelligence capabilities building up. Intelligence is nothing more than information collected and analyzed in response to a question or requirement. And so
we're not talking about hit teams.
We're not talking about hit teams. No, but that is the popular conception. When you talk about intelligence or you talk about intelligence capability, they think, oh, this must be, you know, espionage. It must be criminal and illegal. It must be violent. And it's in the private sector. It's none of those things. It's simply using different capabilities. So social media, for example, you know, you think, you know, NSA and Russian FAPSI and GCHQ, they all collect signals intelligence. Well, signals social media is essentially open source signals intelligence that can be used to help make better decisions. So there was a, you know, I mean, as an example, there was an evacuation in a particular Middle East country, which was undergoing violent change, and a company needed to get its people out to safety. And so we're able to use real-time social media pictures of roads, of scenes in airports, of different pieces to understand, you know, where you would be more safe, where you'd be less safe, to help get people out. So there's that, that's, you know, purely an intelligence mission and capability. So, and the limitations in that are only limited by the creativity, the amount of data that's being generated every day that's available, and that can be used and analyzed against the right questions, are unlimited. And I think in many ways, private sector is outstripping government in terms of how it gets used. Bellingham, you're probably familiar with Bellingcat.
Oh, yeah.
Not, you absolutely need to be. This is a group of, you know, started out of a guy's kitchen table that was interested in what kind of munitions were being used in Syria and using, you know, pictures being posted on social media, has now turned into an unbelievably effective and powerful investigative organization, that has had, some reporting coups, I would call them successes, that any intelligence agency would be proud of, using entirely open source methods and technology. Yeah. And I mean, they really are amazing. I mean, and part of it is, I think that, you know, when in government agencies are so focused on secret information and on the information that they can collect through their exquisite capabilities, whether it's human or technical, highly classified, very expensive, often quite risky. But if you don't have access to that, as Bellingcat and private companies don't, you have to be more creative in terms of how do you answer this question or solve this problem? And what you find out is if you're not tethered to the, you know, to this, you know, security leash and compartmentation and secrecy leash, and you let your mind roam free about what's out there and what can be collected, openly, then it's amazing what can be done.
Paul Colby, thank you so much for coming on to Replan and taking us through all this.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Matthew.
That's all for this week, Angry Planet listeners. As always, Angry Planet is me, Matthew Galt, Jason Fields, and Kevin Nodell. It was created by myself and Jason Fields. If you like the show, please give us $9 a month on Substack. It's angryplanet.substack.com or angryplanetpod.com. You get early access and commercial-free access to the mainline episodes, the bonus episodes, and the occasional post. It really does help us keep the show going. It is a labor of love. We do love doing it. We are kind of downshifting now into the holidays. Anyone who kind of works in media knows that people stop answering their emails after Thanksgiving. So it's a little bit tougher to book guests. We will get out what we can, and we will run some of our greatest hits. We've been doing the show a long time. There's a lot of great episodes that need a little love, need some audio remastering. And we think you're going to like what you hear over the holidays. So I think we'll have a couple more before the end of the year. And then we will come back strong in January. We'll see you then. Stay safe out there.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.